Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So, you want to do business with an American company?
Sounds like a great idea.
Well, today,
Lots of opportunities there.
we're going to dive into American contract law.
Oh,
We're going deep,
okay.
not just skimming the surface here. We're going to uncover some of the surprising aspects of American contracts that might not be obvious. Our guide for this journey
Okay.
is a fascinating legal guide called Der Amerikanische Vertrag.
Interesting title. What does
Yeah.
that mean?
That means the American contract.
Okay.
It's by attorney Clemens Kutschinke.
Okay, so he's writing for a German audience.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting.
Hey, wait, this is Clemens Kutschinke. I'm the author of the underlying source material, which these speakers discuss really well, and I recommend it to listeners from civil law countries.
So diving into American contract law from that perspective must
Yeah.
be interesting for them.
Yeah, and one of the things he really hits on
Okay.
is that American contract law is built on kind of a unique foundation.
Okay.
It's not a single unified legal system like you might find in other countries. Instead, it's more of a patchwork of different legal traditions and precedents.
Okay, so a patchwork legal system.
Yeah.
That sounds complicated.
It can be. What does that actually mean in practice?
Well, it means that each state, plus other jurisdictions like territories, has its own unique set of laws that govern contracts.
Oh, wow.
So imagine you're drafting a contract and it involves parties from, say, California and New York.
Right.
Your contract has to be watertight in both of those legal environments, which can be quite the challenge.
So it's almost like trying to speak a language that everyone understands,
Yes.
even if they have slightly different dialects.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay.
And just to add another a layer of complexity to this,
Oh, no.
American contracts are very often written with an eye towards potential disputes that could even involve a jury.
What juries? So you're
Yes.
saying everyday people could be deciding the outcome of a contract dispute.
That's right.
Wow.
And this jury factor significantly influences how these contracts are written.
I see. I see. That's probably why American contracts often seem overexplained
Precisely.
compared to contracts in other legal systems.
Because nothing is taken for granted. Every detail, every potential scenario needs to be spelled out clearly so that a jury of average citizens can understand it.
So it's not about being overly wordy, it's about ensuring that everything is crystal clear,
Exactly.
even decades later.
Yes. To borrow a quote that Kuchinki uses, it's from Abraham Lincoln.
Okay.
He said, "If a lawyer defines a cow's tail as a leg, his client can't sell a five-legged cow."
Okay.
So, in other words, clear and unambiguous language is paramount in American contracts, especially with that potential for jury involvement looming.
That's a great analogy. I love that.
Yeah.
So, how does all of this actually play out in the structure of a typical American contract?
Well, Kuchinki.
What are the key components that I should be aware of?
Yeah, he outlines a number of important elements.
Okay.
First, you have the title, of course,
Of course.
which clearly identifies the agreement. Then you have the parties involved, which might seem straightforward, but Kuchinki specifically cautions against using the term partner,
Interesting.
unless a formal partnership is intended.
So even if I have like a fantastic collaborative relationship with a company,
Right.
using the term partner in the contract could have some unforeseen legal consequences.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
It's better to stick with the term parties,
Okay. I'll tell
unless you're
them.
truly entering into like a formal partnership agreement, which has very specific implications for liability and ownership under US law.
Okay, so parties
Yeah.
it is, unless we're talking about a formal partnership.
Yes.
Gotcha. So what comes after identifying the parties?
Typically, you'd have a section for recitals.
Recitals.
Yes, this provides background information and context for the agreement. Think of it as setting the scene for the contract.
Okay, so it's like giving the jury and anyone else who might read the contract later a clear understanding of the why behind the agreement.
Precisely.
Okay. Then we come to what's often considered the heart of the contract,
Okay.
the consideration.
Consideration.
This is the mutual exchange of promises that forms the basis of the entire agreement.
So consideration refers to what each party is bringing to the table, what they're agreeing to do.
Precisely. And Kuchinki really stresses the importance of bargaining and negotiation when it comes to consideration.
Okay.
American contract law places a heavy emphasis on this back and forth process to ensure both parties are entering into the agreement freely and fairly.
So I can't just present a contract as a take it or leave it deal.
Not if you want it to hold up in court. Both sides need to demonstrate that they actively participated in the negotiation process.
Okay.
And that the resulting agreement represents a genuine meeting of the minds.
That's really interesting. So American contract law really places a high value on this idea of balanced bargaining.
Absolutely.
Even if the parties are on friendly terms.
It's about protecting the interests of both parties and ensuring that the agreement is truly a product of genuine negotiation, not coercion or undue influence.
Okay, makes sense. So what happens after we've established this consideration through bargaining?
Well, then the contract will typically lay out the specific obligations and rights of each party.
Okay.
This is where that over-explained nature of American contracts really shines through. Everything needs to be spelled out in detail, leaving no room for ambiguity.
Because we're trying to preempt those potential arguments in front of a jury.
Exactly. We need to make sure that everything is clear and understandable, even to someone with no legal background.
I'm starting to get at the picture. So after outlining those rights and obligations, what comes next?
That's where we get into some really important sections. Warranties and limitations of liability.
Okay, warranties, limitations of liability. Can you explain what those are and how they fit into this whole structure?
Of course. Warranties are essentially promises about the quality or performance of something being provided under the contract. For example, if you're selling a product, you might warrant that it's free from defects.
Makes sense. And limitations of liability, I'm guessing, are about setting boundaries on how much one party might be responsible for if something goes wrong.
You got it. It's all about being upfront and clear on what each party is promising and what they're not promising. Remember, we're trying to minimize the risk of those disputes and avoid ending up in front of a jury.
Right, right, of course. This is all making a lot more sense now. We've covered a lot of ground already, from that unique patchwork nature of American contract law to the importance of bargaining and clarity in drafting.
And we've only just scratched the surface.
Oh, boy.
There's still so much more to explore, from the intricacies of remedies and indemnification to those often overlooked but crucial general terms.
Sounds like we have a lot more to dive into. But before we move on, is there anything that's particularly stood out to you about the unique characteristics of American contract law?
Well, what's really fascinating to me is how the system is designed with the expectation of potential disputes, and that juries, everyday people, might be involved in deciding the outcome.
Right.
This leads to a level of meticulous detail and explicitness that you might not find in other legal systems.
Yeah, it's almost like every clause is being written with that jury in mind.
Exactly.
Anticipating their questions.
Yes.
And potential interpretations. And speaking of interpretations, we haven't even touched on those modal verbs Coach Inky talks about. Shall, should, may. I have a feeling those are incredibly important in this context.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Those seemingly small words carry a lot of weight in American contracts and can have a huge impact on how a clause is interpreted. We'll definitely be unpacking those in detail.
This is already so insightful. I can tell there's still so much more to uncover.
Definitely.
But for now, let's take a pause here. Join us next time as we delve deeper into the specific elements of an American contract. From remedies and indemnification to termination clauses and those crucial general terms.
Looking forward to it.
I am too.
It'll be great.
All right. See you next time.
See you then.
Hello again. This is Clemens Kohinka, the author. And if you would like to read this material in German, go to fluglektüre.com.
Welcome back to our deep dive.
It's great to be back.
Into American contract law.
Last time we talked about the whole jury factor.
Oh, right.
Which I have to admit is a bit intimidating.
It can be, yeah.
I'm eager to learn more about how these contracts are actually structured.
Well, let's jump right in.
Okay.
To some of the key elements that Coach Inky highlights.
Okay.
In Der Amerikanische Vertrag. One that I find particularly interesting is the concept of remedies.
Remedies?
Yes.
So if one side doesn't hold up their end of the bargain.
Right.
The other side has some recourse.
Right. Precisely. But like most things in American law, it's not quite that simple.
Okay.
You see, the type of remedy available depends on whether it falls under common law or equity.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Common law and equity. Can you unpack those terms for me?
Sure. Think of common law as the traditional, well-established body of legal principles. Remedies under common law usually involve monetary damages, basically. The breaching party pays money to make up for the harm they caused.
Yeah.
Equity, on the other hand, steps in when monetary damages just aren't enough to truly fix the situation.
So if someone steals my company's secret recipe, let's say for a revolutionary new energy drink,
right?
Just getting financial compensation might not cut it.
Exactly.
Okay.
You'd want to stop them from using that store and recipe altogether. That's where equity comes in with remedies like injunctions.
Okay.
Which can legally prohibit someone from taking a specific action.
So in that scenario, an injunction could prevent them from producing or selling my energy drink.
Precisely. Interesting.
And that's just one example.
Okay.
How equity provides a more nuanced approach to remedies when those common law solutions just fall short.
I see. So this dual system kind of adds a layer of complexity.
It does.
But also flexibility to American contracts.
Absolutely. And that's why it's crucial for anyone dealing with American contracts to consider both common law and equity remedies from the outset.
Yeah.
You want to make sure the contract specifically addresses the types of relief that you might need in case of a breach. So always think about potential problems.
Yes.
And have a plan for how to address them, even before signing on the dotted line.
Exactly.
That's good advice. What else should I be aware of?
Well, Kuchinke also stresses the importance of indemnification clauses.
Okay.
These can get pretty complex.
Indemnification, that sounds a little daunting.
It can be.
Can you break it down for me?
Imagine this. Your company licenses software from an American developer.
Oh,
later, a third party sues your company, claiming that the software infringes on their patent. An indemnification clause in your contract would require that American developer to step in and cover those legal costs, protecting your company from a potentially significant financial burden.
Oh, okay. So it's like an insurance policy.
Yes.
Against lawsuits from outside the contract itself.
That's a great way to think about it. Indemnification is all about allocating risk and ensuring that the right party bears the responsibility for these potential third-party claims.
I can see how that would be a major point of negotiation in a contract.
Oh, absolutely.
What are some of the key things to consider when crafting these clauses?
Well, you want to be very clear about what types of claims are covered.
Okay.
Who's responsible for the legal defense costs.
Okay.
And what the limits of liability are. It's all about anticipating those potential problems.
Right.
And establishing clear rules of engagement.
So it's like having a backup plan for your backup plan.
You could say that. Now, let's shift gears and talk about another important element.
Okay.
Termination.
Termination, okay.
Kuchinke is very adamant that every American contract needs a clear and unambiguous termination clause.
Okay.
Both for ordinary circumstances and in case of a breach.
So you're saying we need a way out.
Yes.
If the agreement isn't working.
Exactly. But again, it's not quite as simple as it might seem.
Okay.
Remember, nothing is assumed in American contract law. If the contract doesn't explicitly state how and when it can be terminated,
right,
you could be stuck with it, even if the circumstances change drastically.
So even if I realize I've made a terrible deal,
right,
I'm still legally bound.
You could be, yes.
If there's no clear exit strategy written into the contract.
That's the risk you run. A solid termination clause is essential.
Okay.
It needs to clearly outline the rights of both parties to terminate the contract, both in ordinary circumstances and in the event of a breach.
So things like notice periods. Specific grounds for termination. What happens to any outstanding obligations if the contract ends early?
Precisely. And it's important to note that the termination terms don't necessarily have to be symmetrical.
Okay.
One party might have a longer notice period or more stringent conditions.
Right.
But both sides need a clear path to exit the agreement.
So when negotiating a contract with an American company, I should always make sure there's a well-defined escape route, even if I don't anticipate needing it.
Absolutely. Now let's move on to what Kuchinke refers to as the general terms.
General terms. That sounds pretty vague.
It does, a bit.
What exactly are we talking about here?
Think of the general terms as the fine print that can have a huge impact on how the contract is interpreted and enforced. This section typically covers things like choice of law, jurisdiction, and dispute resolution methods.
Okay, let's break that down. Choice of law. I'm guessing that determines which state's laws will govern the contract.
Exactly. And this can be crucial.
Right.
Especially when you have parties from different states. You want to make sure the contract is subject to the laws of a jurisdiction that is favorable to your interests.
In jurisdiction, is that about where a potential lawsuit would be filed?
You got it. The jurisdiction clause determines which court will have the authority to hear any disputes arising from the contract.
Okay, so if my company's based in Germany,
right,
I might not want to be dragged into a court in, say, Texas
right.
to resolve a contract dispute.
That's a very valid concern.
Okay, so choice of law and jurisdiction are definitely things to watch out for.
Absolutely.
What are those dispute resolution methods you mentioned?
So this is where you decide how you want to handle any disagreements that might arise. The two most common methods are court litigation and arbitration. Litigation involves going through the traditional court system with judges and juries and all that entails.
Okay.
Arbitration, on the other hand, is a more private process where a neutral third party hears the dispute and makes a binding decision.
So it's like choosing between a public trial and a private hearing.
That's a good analogy. Each approach has its pros and cons.
Okay.
And the best choice will depend on the specific circumstances of the contract and the parties involved.
Wow. I never realized how much complexity is packed into those seemingly boring general terms.
Right. It's easy to skim over them, but they can have a huge impact on how the contract plays out.
The key takeaway here is to read the fine print carefully.
Yes.
And make sure you understand exactly what you're agreeing to, even if it seems tedious.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And don't hesitate to seek legal counsel if you have any doubts.
This has been incredibly informative.
Glad to hear it.
I feel like I'm starting to see the hidden machinery of American contract law.
That's great.
But before we move on, is there anything that's particularly resonated with you about these key elements?
What I find really fascinating is how meticulously American contracts anticipate and address potential problems, from carefully chosen remedies to clearly defined termination procedures, and the detailed attention given to those general terms.
Yeah,
it's all about minimizing risk and ensuring that the agreement works as intended.
It's like a carefully choreographed dance.
Yes.
Where every step is planned in advance to prevent those missteps and keep the music playing smoothly.
That's a great way to put it.
I thought so.
And I think that's a perfect note to end this part of our deep dive on. Next time, we'll be exploring some more of those specific nuances that make American contract law so unique, including those modal verbs we touched on earlier.
I'm already looking forward to it.
Hi, this is Clemens Kochinker again. If you would like to look me up, go to kochinker.com, which is spelled K-O-C-H-I-N-K-E.com.
We're back for the final part of our deep dive into American contract law. It's been quite a journey.
It has been a lot to take in, but we've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, from that jury factor and the dual system of law to the complexities of remedies and those all-important general terms.
Right. We've seen how important clarity and precision are in American contracts.
Absolutely. And speaking of precision.
Yes.
Remember those modal verbs we mentioned earlier?
Yes, those little words that can make a big difference. Kochinke dedicates a whole section to those in their Amerikanische Vertrag, saying they play a crucial role in American contracts.
Right. Those seemingly small words like shall, should, and may. I have a feeling they pack more punch than they appear to.
You got it. In American contracts, these words are definitely not interchangeable. Each one carries a specific legal weight and can significantly impact how a clause is interpreted.
Okay, so what are the key distinctions I need to be aware of?
Well, shall is generally used to express an obligation, something that must be done.
Okay.
For example, the seller shall deliver the goods by July 1st. That creates a firm, legally binding duty on the seller to deliver those goods by that date.
So shall means it's not optional.
Right. It's a must do.
Okay. What about should? Is that just like a softer version of shall?
Not quite. Should is more of a recommendation or a guideline. It suggests a course of action that's advisable, but not necessarily mandatory.
Okay.
For instance, the buyer should inspect the goods upon delivery.
Okay.
This encourages the buyer to do so, but it doesn't create that strict legal obligation like shall would.
So it's a nudge in a certain direction.
Yes.
But not a hard and fast rule.
Exactly.
Okay, and then we have may, which is all about permission or possibility.
Right. It indicates that something is allowed but not required.
Okay.
For example, the parties may amend this agreement in writing.
Okay.
It means they have the option to do so,
right,
but they're not obligated.
So shall is an obligation.
Mm-hmm.
Should is a suggestion, and may is a possibility.
Precisely.
Okay. Are there any other modal verbs that I should be aware of?
Well, Kochinke also mentions the importance of understanding the negative forms of these verbs.
Okay.
Shall not, for instance, is an absolute prohibition.
Okay.
While may not simply restricts a particular action.
So if the contract says the buyer shall not resell the goods, that's a hard stop. they're absolutely forbidden from reselling.
Exactly.
But if it says the buyer may not resell the goods without the seller's written consent, there's still a possibility of reselling, but only under those specific conditions.
You got it. It all comes back to that meticulous attention to detail we've been talking about. Every word counts in American contracts. And even seemingly small words like these modal verbs can have a huge impact on how the agreement is interpreted and enforced.
It seems like crafting or even just reviewing an American contract requires almost surgical precision.
It does.
There's no room for sloppy language.
Right.
Or assuming that everyone will just understand all these nuances.
And that's precisely why it's so crucial to seek legal counsel when you're dealing with American contracts.
Yeah.
An experienced attorney can help you navigate all these complexities and ensure that your interests are protected and that the agreement is structured in a way that minimizes risk and maximizes clarity.
It's like having an expert translator who can decipher the intricacies of this unique legal language.
That's a great way to put it. And remember, even though we've covered a lot in this deep dive,
we have.
We've really just scratched the surface of American contract law. It's a vast and intricate subject,
yeah,
with its own unique set of rules and principles.
Well, you've certainly given me a solid foundation to build upon. So as we wrap up this deep dive, what are the key takeaways that you want our listeners to walk away with?
I think the most important thing to remember is that American contracts are designed to be clear, unambiguous, and enforceable, often with that potential involvement of a jury in mind.
Right.
And this leads to that level of detail and explicitness that might seem unusual at first, but it's all in service of minimizing risk and ensuring that the agreement accurately reflects the intentions of all parties involved.
It's like building a house with reinforced steel and extra strong concrete. You're not expecting a storm, but you're prepared if one comes.
Exactly. And the other key takeaway is to always seek legal guidance. Don't try to navigate the complexities of American contract law on your own. An experienced attorney can be your advocate, your translator, and your guide through this challenging but ultimately fascinating legal landscape.
That's sound advice. Well, it's been a pleasure unraveling the intricacies of American contract law with you. Thank you for sharing your expertise and for making this complex subject so accessible.
The pleasure was all mine. I enjoyed our conversation.
And to our listener, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you've gained some valuable insights that will help you navigate the world of American contracts with confidence. Until next time, keep diving deep.